Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Duct Tape Killer, the true inside story of sexual sadist and murderer Robert Leroy Anderson, by Phil Hammond and Sandy Hammond, with former Attorney General Larry Long, narrated by Perry Daniels. Prologue. Fear, anxiety, and revulsion grip the region as word spread regarding women being abducted, one brazenly taken from her home in broad daylight. The near kidnapping of another who had to fight for her life in a dark, secluded highway escalated the fear. In the tranquil area of southeast South Dakota, where family and religious values flourished, the news was perceived as unreal. When an elite team of investigators cracked the case and details were released to the public, the lives of these women took on a personal feel to the residents of their communities. The deranged mind of Robert Leroy Anderson, a sexual sadist, rapist, and murderer, came to light. We had the privilege of meeting former Attorney General, Judge, and Prosecutor Larry Long. Despite the intense heat of late summer, he wore a long-sleeve white button-up shirt, a whimsical purple paisley tie, and polished black wingtips. He emanated sophistication, and when he spoke, it was with refined wisdom. We sat with objective fascination as Mr. Long shared information about the case with the use of over 100 photos. We discussed the possibilities of writing a book and explained with honesty that we had been contacted by more than a dozen people wanting us to write a book about their life. In the end, we chose to work with Larry Long and write Duct Tape Killer. This tragic account also contains the glimmers of eternal hope and the stories of people who fought to overcome evil rather than succumb to it. Duct Tape Killer is the dark story of a demented man who stalked and planned appalling acts upon his victims. It also depicts the continued struggles good people face in a world filled with unspeakable evil. Phil and Sandy Hammond. Serial killers make up only 0.00039% of the population. The odds of being a victim of this type of killer are astronomically low. Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. New International Version. The Phone Call. July 29, 1996. Something was wrong. 27-year-old Piper Striley, dependable and responsible, had not shown up for work. As an employee of Southeastern Mental Health Outreach, SMHO, she provided home assistance to a mother and son who were both disabled. She was punctual and efficient. So when 3 p.m. rolled around and Piper had not shown up, the mother called SMHO and talked to Piper's co-worker, Patty Sinclair. Piper was an hour late. While Patty dialed Piper's number, she tried to push away a nagging concern. Likely there was a miscommunication that would soon be cleared up. The phone rang repeatedly at the home Piper shared with her husband, Vance, and two young children. Shayna was 3 and a half, and Nathan had turned 2 yesterday. Finally, Patty heard the distinct clatter of the receiver being lifted.
"Hello?"
Shayna said quietly.
"Is your mommy or daddy home?"
Patty asked.
"No."
"Is there a babysitter?"
"No." "They're killed. A mean man carried mommy away."
Click. Patty called back immediately, her pulse rising with each successive ring of the phone, until finally a small voice answered. It was the little girl again, and now she was sobbing hysterically. Patty's gut instinct was to keep the little girl talking, to calm her down.
"When did Mommy leave?"
"A while ago."
"Where did she go?"
"She went with a man in a black car."
"Do you know the man?"
"No. I don't want my mommy to die. I don't want Daddy hurt. I don't want Daddy to die."
Patty was able to get the attention of a co-worker and directed her to call 911. "Have Patty keep talking to the little girl, and we'll try to get more information," the 911 operator directed. So Patty asked the girl her name.
"Shayna,"
she sobbed.
"My mommy is going to die."
She hung up again. Early 1990s, Ukraine. To August 1994, USA. A new life. A better life. That was the dream of Bill and Larissa Domansky. The Ukraine had become unstable as the country sought independence from Russia. Political strife created a terrible economic crisis, and a steady job was difficult to find. Adding to the pressure was the fact that the Domansky family was Christian. Bill's father was a Pentecostal minister, a denomination banned by the government. To avoid the watchful eye of government officials, Christians held worship services at night in the forest or in secluded basements. School teachers encouraged children to denounce God, and those who preached His word lived in constant fear of being arrested and sentenced to prison, tortured, or executed. Through the efforts of the Lutheran Social Services, the Domanskys qualified for asylum due to religious persecution and settled in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where they joined his parents, brother, and five sisters. This city, nestled in the southeast corner of the state, was the largest city in South Dakota, though it boasted a population of less than 100,000. The winding Big Sioux River, with its cascading waterfalls, along with pristine parks and pre-war Japanese gardens, immediately felt like home to Bill and Larissa. The city would, in fact, become nationally ranked as the best city to live in the United States, based on numerous factors, including health care, employment, home prices, and low crime rates. The citizens of the Midwestern town did not readily tolerate crime, and many neighborhoods worked with the police department to form watch groups. When both Bill and Larissa landed good-paying jobs at the local John Morrell meatpacking plant, the couple knew they could provide a stable life for their two daughters, Christina and Regina. The factory loomed over the north side of Sioux Falls like a brick and steel giant, with towering smokestacks stretching to the sky. The plant skirted the lower-income housing areas that crept into the extreme northeast part, known for its aging homes, with front porches, family dogs roaming free, and backyards dotted with yellow dandelions beneath clotheslines. The packing house ran shifts around the clock and processed beef, pork, and lamb to sell across the nation. It was a welcome job for many immigrants like Bill and Larissa, who wanted to get a solid start. Gradually, the couple began to get ahead financially. Bill left Morrell's and took a day shift laying carpet and flooring, while Larissa continued working the night shift at the packing house from 4 p.m. to 1 a.m. She would go home, shower, then slip into bed so as not to wake Bill. She would snuggle next to her husband, even more so as their love had deepened. Larissa was 6 weeks pregnant. A Husband's Distress, July 29th, 1996, late afternoon. McCook County Sheriff Gene Taylor was dispatched to the Stryley residence, a trailer house located west of Sioux Falls, near Canastota. He was not informed about the conversation between the employees of SMHO and the 911 operator, but was only told to check on the welfare of a child. The locals made frequent comparisons between their own Sheriff Taylor and television Sheriff Andy Taylor from The Andy Griffith Show, due to his easygoing yet alert nature. In 1966, he was drafted for the Vietnam War. When his commander asked for volunteers to become military police, Taylor said, "I must have gotten my hand up faster than some of the others." He was one of the few chosen to be trained as an MP. He returned home and became sheriff a decade later, a title he would hold for 28 years. Upon approaching the Stryley trailer, Taylor felt immediately unsettled. Three steps led to a large deck off the entrance to the trailer. He noted that the bottom board was knocked off, and the second step was broken, tilted at an awkward angle. For some reason, it looked as though it had recently occurred. The front door hung open, and a gaping hole stood where there should have been glass in the screen door. Taylor knocked and called out, "This is Sheriff Taylor. Is anyone home?" He called out several more times, to no avail, although he heard young voices inside the home. Since he came to check on the welfare of children, he decided to enter the residence. He opened the door and immediately knew something was amiss. The crowded living room, a testament to the many household items required when raising children, was clean but cluttered, with a mass of toys and stuffed animals strewn liberally about the sofa, floor, and upright piano. A chair and ironing board, among other items, were tipped over or in disarray. A steak knife protruded from a wastebasket near the front door.
"It looks like there was a struggle, and that someone left in a hurry."
A woman's purse lay surrounded by a checkbook, calculator, and bills. He called out again, but there was still no answer. Taylor entered the hallway and spotted a small girl, who burst into tears. He bent down to look her in the eyes.
"Do you know where your mom is?"
"My mommy is going to die."
"Is your mom in the hospital?"
"No."
The girl hugged herself and cried uncontrollably. Taylor heard a small noise in one of the bedrooms, and a boy, hardly more than a toddler, came running to his sister's side. Taylor asked a few more questions, which only caused her to cry harder. He immediately called for backup, and a horde of authorities converged on the scene, including Division of Criminal Investigation Agent Jim Severson. He knelt on one knee and had Shayna sit on the other knee. He gently began asking her what happened. She continued crying and squeezed her hands together nervously.
"A bad man and a black truck came. There was a loud noise and Mommy said to get Nathan and hide."
Shayna's answers were interrupted by the ringing of the phone in another room. Taylor picked up the receiver.
"Hello?"
"Who is this?"
the voice on the other end demanded.
"This is McCook County Sheriff, Gene Taylor. Who is this?"
"Vance Stryley. I'm looking for my kids. Is something wrong?"
Unable to make contact with his wife around noon, Vance assumed the children would be at the babysitter's house and went there.
"Your kids are safe, but I need you to come home as soon as possible."
Vanished. August 27, 1994. The continued buzzing of the alarm clock brought Bill Demansky out of a deep sleep. His wife, Larissa, always turned it off, but today, the piercing noise continued. Morning sun rays shimmered through the curtains, causing him to stir and open his eyes. He rolled onto his side, but something wasn't right. Larissa was not in bed. Thinking she'd gone up for some reason, he walked through the house, but his wife was nowhere, and her minivan was not in the driveway. Bill threw on some clothes and made a few phone calls to friends and co-workers, who also had not seen Larissa. His concern turned to anxiety. He phoned two hospital emergency rooms to see if something might have happened. Then he decided to drive around in hopes of locating his wife. She had definitely arrived at work by 4 p.m. the previous day, since she called Bill during her break. She was happy and in a playful mood. They were having guests the next day and discussed the menu. By 7:30 a.m., he was driving through the employee parking lot, scanning the stretching rows of vehicles, until he finally spotted her minivan, just ahead, and let out a small sigh of relief. He parked behind the van, but his stomach clenched at the first thing he noticed. The front driver's side tire was completely flat, and even more disturbing were the van keys dangling from the driver's side door lock. Bill rushed to a telephone and called the police. Although the detectives were concerned, they also operated from the standpoint of realizing that she could be with a friend or relative. In 99% of cases nationwide, the missing person is located within 24 hours. Lieutenant Gary Folkerts explained this fact to Bill, but because of the unusual circumstances, including the flat tire and key left in the door, the detectives soon opened a missing persons case. They dusted the minivan for fingerprints and checked other forensic details, but it showed nothing of value. When asked about the flat tire, Bill explained that she had recurring flat tires in the last 2 months, most of which happened in the Morell's parking lot. Twice, her tires were punctured. Bill claimed to have checked the tires himself and found a cut in the valve stem of the tire, which caused a slow leak. The explanation was unconvincing, and Bill became a primary suspect. Another suspicious situation arose. Knowing how difficult it was to be an immigrant in a new country, Larissa was helping a Russian co-worker who lost his driver's license for operating a vehicle while intoxicated. He was on work release from the county jail for a couple of months, and Larissa gave him a ride back to the jail each night, since they worked the same hours. An agent immediately began checking out the man's story. There were thousands of other leads as well. Morell's employed 3,600 people who might know something. However, the field was narrowed to 100 people most likely to have had contact with Larissa. Knowing that a perpetrator could be orbiting around her workplace, six FBI agents were brought in to help with the interviews, but none of them yielded anything of value. It felt as if they were cornering smoke. Each promising lead that surfaced turned to disappointment, including the one with the Russian co-worker. The man worked later than usual on the morning Larissa disappeared. He looked for her, but she was gone, so he found another employee to give him a ride back to jail, where he promptly checked back in. His story was solid. Bill's explanation of the flat tires checked out, too. Investigators brought the van to a mechanic, who tested each tire and determined that there was no reason any of them should have gone flat, unless someone tampered with them. In early September 1994, top headlines across the nation focused on the World Series. Due to a strike by major league players, the series was canceled for the first time in 90 years. But in the tri-state area around Sioux Falls, people anxiously followed stories about the search for Larissa.
It might take an outside tip to solve this thing, Lieutenant Folkers told an Argus Leader reporter. To encourage people to come forward, Morell's and Professional Carpet Systems, where Bill was employed, offered an $8,000 reward. The community pulled together. Friends and volunteers passed out thousands of flyers, asking for citizens to come forward with information about Larissa. The Minnehaha County Emergency Management Office directed a search along railroad tracks, gravel pits, and wooded areas near roads where a vehicle could easily dump a body and get back out quickly. They searched with dogs and helicopters. Dedicated people who believed she was abducted formed an organization called the Friends of Larissa. Many in the group were the Demansky's church, and their friends worked over Labor Day weekend to send out 4,000 letters with Larissa's photo and information. The group took to foot and canvassed the neighborhood. They printed 5,000 cards with her photo and distributed these to stores that sold hunting and fishing licenses. Knowing that hunters coming into the state for the upcoming pheasant season would be tramping through outlying fields and thickets. Sergeant Larry Gullickson led a search team comprised of civil defense volunteers and police along the river, even though they had no direct tip that she was there. It was part of their thoroughness, along with using one of the hospital's helicopters to search the area around Sioux Falls. The investigators worked overtime, re-interviewing certain co-workers, friends, and family who were of special interest. Detectives put press releases in the newspaper, asking for help with clues, including information on Larissa's handmade purse from the Soviet Union, which she likely had when she disappeared. Calls came in from psychics wanting to help locate Larissa, as well as the typical crackpot calls that did nothing but waste investigators' time. They exhausted remote leads and even looked into whether her disappearance had anything to do with Ringling Brothers Circus, which had been in town the same weekend as her disappearance. Morell's doubled the amount of reward money, yet the phone calls from citizens offering tips dwindled.
I can't think of a case where we've worked harder, Folkerts was quoted as saying in the newspaper.
By mid-September, the case stalled. Detectives were frustrated and ran out of leads. They couldn't get traction and never felt they were on the cusp of a hot lead. The case would have to be shelved. But Lieutenant Gary Folkerts planned to continue monitoring similar disappearances throughout the Midwest. None of the investigators involved could forget an unsolved case of this magnitude. It lay just beneath their skin, in hopes that some unexpected clue would arise to solve the mystery of her disappearance. Bill was cleared as a suspect early in the investigation. Though that was an obvious relief, the house seemed airless without Larissa. It was her love of life that added a sparkle to their family. Larissa had embraced this new country with fervor. She learned to speak English quickly and fluently. The family had built a new house a few months earlier. As the sad, lonely days passed, Bill tried to become proficient at household duties that came naturally to Larissa. He eventually learned how to do the laundry and other cleaning, but lacked even basic cooking skills. His mother cooked traditional Russian meals for them, and friends regularly brought food to the house. It was the seemingly mundane daily events that tugged at his heartstrings the most, like the day his youngest daughter came running to announce she'd lost her first tooth and wanted to tell her mommy. Every night, he and the children hoped and prayed that Larissa would return. Days of worry drifted into weeks, then months. Bill left everything in the house just as it was the day his wife disappeared. He couldn't give up hope. Sometimes he'd think he spotted her in a store, but then he'd get closer and realize it wasn't her. Visits from friends tapered off,
He assumed it was too uncomfortable for people to come around and not know what to say. The weekends were the hardest. There were just too many hours to fill without Larissa. For the close-knit family, the feeling of waiting on edge became their new normal. Young Love, mid-1980s to 1996. With its snow-capped mountains, moss-stripped forests, and winding Owyhee Canyon lands, Oregon beckoned to Vance Dryly with its beauty. He packed up and left the cornfields and prairie grasses of South Dakota for a place where the Pacific waves caress a scalloped shoreline adorned with both rocky and sandy beaches. The scenic cliffs appealed to Vance as a setting where he could continue with higher education. Perhaps nature's peace and beauty would parallel the desires he held for his future. He was excited and optimistic about starting this new chapter in his life. God guided his decision to enter Canyon View Bible School and Seminary, where he planned to become ordained and lead a church someday. At the same time, Piper Potts, a good-natured and well-liked homecoming queen from Rio Medina, Texas, had committed to attending the same college, with similar plans to follow God's will for her life. Piper was born February 11, 1968. When her father held his newborn baby daughter, he immediately thought she would have a special name, Piper. He liked the first name of actress Piper Laurie, and being an amateur pilot, admired the Piper Cub airplane. Along with her three brothers, the family lived in Ohio for most of Piper's childhood and moved back to Texas before she started high school. Piper threw herself into school activities, playing clarinet, performing with the flag team, and serving as a statistician for the baseball and basketball teams. As fate would have it, Vance and Piper crossed paths repeatedly. Vance was intrigued with Piper's positive attitude toward life, and he soon found himself hopelessly attracted to this petite, energetic woman with shoulder-length brown hair. Conversations led to their common goals of starting a church, working with children, and organizing a Bible camp where kids could not only have fun, but learn about Christ. Piper was the all-American girl next door. Vance would later comment,
"I met this gal called Piper, and I thought to myself, that is some gal. That is the gal I want to marry."
Nature took its course. They fell deeply in love and exchanged wedding vows 2 years later in 1989. Before long, more joy arrived with the birth of daughter Shayna, and 2 years later, a son, Nathan, came along. The Strileys returned to South Dakota and made their home on a 40-acre piece of rural property west of Sioux Falls. Their home was south of Lake Vermilion, where in summer, tiny wildflowers dotted the grasslands and waves of purple from clover patches added hues of color. In the morning and evening, white-tailed deer appeared in the meadows, and colorful ring-neck pheasants cackled from the grain fields, like a scene from a Terry Redland painting. Piper and Vance worked diligently to achieve their dreams. They opened Prairie View Bible Camp on their property during the summer. Vance took leave from his plumbing job to work as a camp counselor, and Piper, who worked part-time, taught Bible lessons to the young campers. They owned a small bus and picked up the day campers each morning and drove them home at the end of each day. The camp offered crafts, archery, and a swimming hole, all interspersed with Bible lessons. Anyone who drove by could see the camp shelter that covered rows of wooden pews, which were used on Sundays for outdoor worship. The couple could not have been more pleased with the progress they were making in reaching others with God's word. Their church was coming to life. Vance and Piper located a Catholic church down the road.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?